It is nice to be back with you this morning. It has been a couple of years. Now, normally, I've been invited back about every year. We've worked it out that I can come back about every year, but now it's been a little longer than that. And most congregations, I'm thrilled to be invited back every couple of years, or even every couple of decades, frankly. If I can get back in somebody's place, you know, every once in a while, I'm happy with that, but y'all had kind of spoiled me. And so I've been hurting, frankly, but I'm feeling all better this morning. So it's nice to be back with you. For those of you who I haven't met before, David Radcliffe, I work with New Community Project. I'm Church of the Brethren member, used to work on the national office at the National Office of the Church of the Brethren. And then in 2003, we founded New Community Project. We sort of launched it. And now, 14 years later, about 11,000 people in our network around the country. We have partners in seven countries around the world where we do girls' education, women's development, and some reforestation. We call ourselves a small Christian nonprofit organization with a big goal to change the world. And I'm sure that's part of your mission statement as well here at Lincolnshire. So I've had some experiences since I saw you last. I'll talk some in the after the lunch. I'll have a few minutes to show some pictures and tell some stories. We were in a pygmy community in East Africa in May. I'll be sharing some pictures and stories from that. We already had a sustainable living center in Virginia where we practice all these things in a local setting. We now opened one in a foreign land, Vermont. They do talk funny up there. So I'll have a few pictures from that and some other things. So I'll kind of give you some updates then. And while I was gone these last couple of years, you done gone and got yourself not one, but two new leaders. So really happy to see you all here in this congregation. I don't know whether to use the word positive. It's a match made in heaven. But I'll just say, I'm sure God will bless your time together as leaders in a congregation. And we do go back. Yes, we have some interest in and affection for Alaska. We share that in common. And so that's something that sort of binds us together. And I know you a bit, and New Community Project, I think we have some common interests and affections related to this world and wanting it to be more like God has in mind for this world to be, God's creation, God's children everywhere, our common concerns, about the struggles facing both God's creation and God's children. These days, God's creation, every system under stress. And I'm talking about the basic things. We're talking water here. By 2050, as much plastic as fish in the world's oceans. Not good for things that live there. And I just read the week before last that 94% of U.S. tap water has plastic particles in it. Probably not good for us. We're probably plastic coated on the inside by now. So even the very basic things, air, the air we breathe, 1 out of 1,000 human beings we'll die from air pollution around the world this year. That seems like a crime against humanity. Half of those walking around outside, mostly from fossil fuel pollution, but the other half, women and children who cook their food on the floors of their homes in the poor world from indoor air pollution. About every 20 seconds, a woman or a child dies around the world from breathing indoor cook smoke fire, which is a function of their poverty and inability to have something more substantial, even just to cook their own food. And we might say weather. I used to think we could foul the streams and fell the forest, but at least we couldn't mess with the weather. I took some solace in that, frankly. I thought it was too big for even us to mess up. Silly me. We done gone and warmed the whole place. I actually brought a few pictures this morning from my big backyard. There we're going to start right there. So I had been living in Arizona. I just moved back to Virginia, my home area. But when in Arizona, on the west side of our wall there, we had a trellis, as you can see, and a hummingbird mother made her nest on the west side of our wall. Now, I was quite excited because hummingbirds are kind of mythical creatures. They, you know, you don't really understand them. They seem to defy the laws of motion as they flit around in your backyard. So there the mother was. Then I went up and on stepladder with my cell phone, she was having family. She was starting a family. So there's the two eggs in the nest. I went up about the time. I went on WikiLeaks to try to find out when they should be born. And I wanted to see the little fledglings. When I went up there, I couldn't see a thing. But they're in the bottom of the nest there. Two little, not even feathery blobs, but they're in the bottom of the nest there. And then they began to, the next time I went up, I rustled some of the leaves on the grapevines that we have there, and they thought I was Mama coming home with lunch. Well, I guess Mama regurgitates the stuff she had that day. I'm not sure I could pull that off. Plus, I had pizza for lunch. I'm not sure if it's on their diet. Anyways, there they are getting bigger. They're like elementary school aged hummingbird babies there. So there they are getting bigger, our little family. And I put a dime in the nest. Now, maybe all of you were familiar with hummingbird nest sizes. I was not. I was shocked at the size of the nest. And you got two babies in there, okay? Anyway, there's a dime in the nest. Then they're getting old. No, then this was March before last. I saw them silhouetted against the wall. Great photo opportunity. I got out my real camera and took a couple of pictures. And as I looked at them on my camera screen there, I realized these hummingbirds look stressed. And actually, I told a friend of mine, Dustin Wilgers, a biology professor at McPherson College. I was there later that spring, and I said to him, what is happening? He said, yes, that's how hummingbirds respirate. That's how they cool themselves. They're like dogs. They don't sweat. They have to pant. And so that's what was going on there. Then I realized it was 13 degrees above normal that day. It was 94 rather than 81, which it typically is at that point in March. So I realized these hummingbirds. So when I posted these pictures, and I really thought they were going to die when I saw the kind of stress they were under. And I posted these pictures on Facebook a couple of weeks later, which, you know, if you don't post it on Facebook, it really didn't happen. And so I posted on Facebook, and a friend of mine in Fort Wayne, actually, at the St. Francis University, I want to say, St. Francis U, she saw the pictures. She said, yes, you're in Fort Wayne last spring, same situation. Had a mother robin with five eggs on the west side of our house. They hatched. It was warmer than normal. The chicks died one by one. So I says to Dawn, I need to do something. I need to put up a shade structure. She said, won't you be interfering with nature? Because, you know, things live and die in nature. I told her, we already interfered with nature. When we turned up the heat of the planet and didn't tell Mama Hummingbird, she needs to start this process a month earlier now if she wants to succeed. So we'd been cutting some things in the front yard that day, and I put up a shade structure. So they had it made in the shade, and they survived. Then I went up about the time that they're supposed to leave. I look it up, you know, online to see how long they're in the nest, and once they leave, they never come back. For one thing, they've outgrown it. Where's even Mama going to be right now? Anyway, so I went up, this was the day before Easter, right about the time they're supposed to leave. So I gave them Easter off. Then I came back Monday morning, climbed up on the stepladder. They were gone. So my story is, they rose up on Easter Sunday. That's how I'm telling it. And then they actually they're territorial, so they didn't leave the yard. And so are the hummingbirds still around, on through the spring, on through the summer, into the next year, etc. So that's my hummingbird story, and I'm sticking to it. What we are doing to God's creation is not fair. And that's one of the things, along with growing up in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains outside of Roanoke, Virginia. What we're doing to God's creation is not fair. So I developed an appreciation for the natural world, God's earth, by just being there. And my dad would always close his prayers with, and thank you, God, for the beauties of nature. And then that coupled with my feeling of just fairness for what we were doing to God's earth these days has sort of gotten me along that environmental path, and maybe some of the rest of you as well, for your own reasons. And then what we were doing to the environment for how it affects us is just plain stupid. I mean, overpolluting the air, overpolluting the water, all the other kinds of things that we were doing. We're putting our own future in jeopardy, mostly for consumption and convenience. Mostly for consumption and convenience. In the present tense. We're not thinking about the future. And of course, many of our neighbors don't have the luxury of thinking about the future. They're really focused on today because, yes, the basics, they need them very desperately. Having a home, one out of 100 human beings today is a refugee. They say there are 65 million refugees. There's only 7 billion of us in the world. That's one out of 100. One out of 100 people have had to leave their home, all they hold dear, not to mention their gardens and their other kinds of livelihood kinds of things that they needed, and their shelter, and their family and friends, perhaps, to go flee either a war or the latest environmental catastrophe or whatever. And our nation is closing the door. Maybe you've seen next year we're going to have to admit the fewest refugees we have in memory, even though often our wars and some of our environmental actions have caused many of these refugees to have to flee. And yet we're going to slam the door, or at least close it to a narrow slit. And of course, food. The number of hungry people in our world, once declining, is on the rise again for all the reasons mentioned above. The climatic issues, water quality issues, wars, and that sort of thing. And then even here in our own country, we're doubling down on military spending, it seems to me, and backing off on everything else from health care to public education to protecting our natural areas. We were out in Sequoia and Yosemite this past September, just a few weeks ago, hiking and camping. two of our signature national parks in the United States. Sequoia with its massive trees, the largest living things on Earth. And then Yosemite with its massive massifs, rocks that sort of defy the imagination for how they could just be there, sheer and beautiful and wonderful. Both of these parks are, however, overcrowded, understaffed, overwhelmed by changes in the climate that is causing all through the forest there, out of order. The sinks were clogged for the last 2 weeks, the guy told us there at the campground. They couldn't get any help up to do them, and now we want to cut the budget for these places, even though they're struggling as they are. In Sequoia, it really looked like a war zone in many places. The forest had been so decimated by the bark beetles. These bark beetles, which you maybe have heard about, but they're over-multiplying because the winters are warmer now, not killing off the larva. The trees are stressed by drought, and they have their way with these forests. Now we want to cut the budget, and we want to delete any reference to climate change on the EPA website, et cetera, et cetera. There's only one creature that puts its head in the sand as danger approaches. It's not the ostrich. Unfortunately, it's us. But why wouldn't we? Who wants to deal with these problems? Who wants to face up to this stuff at home or afield? Makes you want to plug your ears, shut your eyes, harden your heart. Fortunately, the Bible provides another option: to look, to listen, to feel, and to mourn. Yes, mourn. Meaning that we look at our world with our eyes and our heart wide open and take it in, let it affect us, bring us to a place of lament, which is a synonym, I think, for mourn, deep sorrow for what we see and hear and feel. Like Jesus, weeping over Jerusalem, how often would I have gathered you like a hen gathers her chicks? But you would not. And like Jeremiah, which I'll hopefully make some sense of here, his people had abandoned God and now were about to meet their fate. He grieves. At one point he says, "My eyes are a fountain of tears." And like us, evidently, this posture of lament is not just for the Jesuses and the Jeremiahs, but also for the Joneses. And I've used that name because I don't, it's sort of the one they always use. I don't know if there's any Joneses in the crowd here this morning, but it's also for the Joneses, meaning by all of us, regular people who look out at their world with the eyes of Christ and are pained by what they see. In fact, these people merit a beatitude from our Lord. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Now, this is not saying that their pain will suddenly dissipate, or if they pray hard enough, all these troubles will go away, but that in their deep sorrow for our world, God will be with them. Us. In our deep sorrow for our world, God will be with us. We might say grieving along with us. Yet, ironically, if these problems are to eventually go away, for at least be offset or confronted, it will most likely be by those who mourn, for they have seen and felt and then want to do something about to make things better in some way. Only if we look at our world in the eye and feel the pain there are we often motivated then to figure out what we need to be doing on it with God's help to make this place better. Seeing and feeling, regardless of the pain and anger that we may feel. In fact, building on those then, letting them energize us to be agents of God's change in this world. In other words, turning mourning with a U to mourning without the U. Their sadness turning to a new day. Through the energy that has been awakened within us by the things we have boldly faced rather than strategically avoided. This past Tuesday, I was speaking to a library full of seventh graders in Warrensburg, Missouri. I do that, that's my annual week in Warrensburg that I spend doing schools, colleges, churches. It was mostly an environmental presentation, and I wasn't pulling any punches with these kids. I mean, they're seventh graders now. I don't quite get so tough nails with the fifth graders or the third graders, but with the seventh graders, I'm figuring they can take it. So I'm laying it all out there, all the troubles that are facing the world around us. Both, I'm talking about the beauty and the magnificence and vitality of the world and the threats facing all these things. I show pictures, tell stories, and generally try to get them to care. That's the point. Generally try to get them to care. Well, it may have worked. At the end of the session, when I asked the kids, all the seventh graders, what can a kid like you do to better care for this earth, one smallish African-American kid on the couch right in front of me there in the seventh grade crowd said, "We have to get wild crazy." That was what he said. He said, "We have to get wild crazy." And I think what he meant was, we've got to just go overboard if we want to get this place back in a good place for ourselves as young children growing up and the future we're going to inherit, but also for the sake of this world around us. We've got to get wild crazy. Well, I think that's what we're talking about. Turning toward our world fully enough to appreciate the vitality, the beauty, the possibilities there, both of people and planet, but not avoiding those things that challenge both people and planet around us. And then letting these things evoke in us what it will, including wild, crazy caring for the stuff that we see around us and the troubles there. And then let that move us and those around us in a better direction. On our last May, our learning tour group was at the Pagarinya refugee camp in Uganda. This is 4 or 5 months ago. Pagarinya refugee camp in Uganda, home to 240,000 South Sudanese, mostly women and children. My first visits to refugee camps full of South Sudanese refugees was in 1993. And since then, war and its companions, intermittent education, poverty, violence against women, separated families, regularly fleeing here, there, or somewhere else to protect yourself and your family, all these have been part of the lives of South Sudan since then, and even before that. It's just what it means to be South Sudanese. Why were we at Pagarinya in May? Because a little over a year ago, the people there were fleeing out of South Sudan into Uganda, the biggest refugee exodus in the world at that time, fleeing to places like Pagarinya or Bidi Bidi, which has over 400,000 refugees, another camp in Uganda, to escape the civil war that's currently going on there, including Mary, whose story that our friend Agnes told me after, you know, as this was proceeding, I asked Agnes for some stories of women caught in these situations, and Mary was one of them. Mary, she didn't know where her husband was. You know, these men, they're off in the war, they're dead in the fighting, they're crazy from the fighting, or often they just abandoned their wives and their families. Anyway, she didn't know where her husband was. The war was moving closer to her home in Juba, South Sudan, the capital. Her children were in jeopardy, the sons of being abducted into the military, the daughters of just being abducted. She knew that they had to flee, so they did. Footing, they say in South Sudan, footing 100 miles to the Ugandan border, no food along the way, a little water, she told me later. 14 days of travel, she and her children. And then she and the others that had been traveling with her arrived at the border town of Nimele, exhausted, disoriented, near starvation. It happens that Nimele is the home of our friend and co-worker in South Sudan, Agnes Amalito, who found them there, lying by the road, gathered up food from the community, like you're having a covered dish meal. You know, then it ain't Fort Wayne in Nimele, but gathered up food from the community to feed them, got them recuperated, showed them where the refugee resettlement place was, really saved their lives. Well, in the process of all this, they learned about Agnes, her work with us, and the work we do with women and girls. So once they got established in the camp, a few weeks later, they sent a message to Agnes and to us saying, "Our country is moving backwards. We want to improve ourselves, these women." Now, you know, they sent us a proposal then for skills training, workshops for tailoring and beautician stuff. I'll show you some of these pictures after a while. It's microloans to start small businesses, scholarships for their daughters to go to school in the nearby communities. These women had $22,800 total, and we raised $23,000 and sent it. But these women, having literally faced the four horsemen of the apocalypse, having seen the worst in human nature, having lost many family members and themselves often been brutalized, and now in a refugee camp where life is no picnic, they weren't daunted. Even there, they were able to choose to make something better out of their tragic situation, to turn their mourning and lament into mourning without the you, moving forward toward a better day. So after we arrived last May, they were singing and dancing to welcome you in those situations. If any of you have been to an African community, you know this is often how it works, especially in the rural areas or in a refugee camp. They're singing and dancing to welcome us. They recited many of their current and past struggles that they faced as women in their country and now in a refugee camp. And then they told us, in spite of these many difficulties, we have not lost our faith in God. And now want to prepare ourselves for some better future. When it was my turn to talk, I told them what an honor it was to be able to play some small role in the plans they were making to improve their own lives and those of their families. And then I told them they reminded me of Jeremiah. As the invaders were approaching, when many of his fellow Israelites had fled, even as disaster loomed, he put down a stake in the future, buying a parcel of land in a city about to be overrun. Wise real estate investment? We can imagine the conversation with the land assessor. You know what you're doing, man? You realize what's coming around the corner? Aren't you the guy that was predicting this? You can imagine all this conversation happening there. Things looked bleak, desperate, even doomed. Plenty to lament, plenty to mourn, but the darkness may yet turn to dawn. I'm willing to bet on it, he said. I'm willing to bet on it, to invest myself in it. As Jeremiah, so those women. And I'm thinking, we don't really do refugee work. That's not part of our work as New Community Project. But when those women put themselves out there like this for this better future, how could we not respond? We called our campaign, We Called You, because we felt called. Hopefully so to us. There's much to mourn in our world on many fronts. And it doesn't have to be the things I'm caring about in New Community, but we've all got our pet things that we're deeply concerned about in this world. Many people having to deal with these things by pretending they aren't there. A lot of people around us in our society, that's kind of how we perceive this. Or simply looking the other way. You know, you look at the tag on your shirt, made in Bangladesh. That's interesting. And move on with life, not thinking about the women, the collapse of the factories over there, and the kind of extreme working conditions they're under. And a church, and even churches, you know, they know how to avoid these things. A friend of mine in West Virginia says in her church, there's frequent sermons about the evils of instrumental music in services and how that can be a test of salvation for our congregation. And I'm thinking, huh? Is that what we got to talk about here in the church? To me, that feels like a diversion from the things that people of Christ really need to be thinking about in this world as, we might say, tests for our salvation. And I think of Matthew 25, when did we see thee? When did we see thee? But I think Jesus calls us then to this other way of loving, if we may say. If we may tweak the Church of the Brethren tagline a little bit, other way of living. Jesus calls us to another way of loving, a deeper level of caring, which includes seeing our world for what it is. Moving backwards, we might say, on many fronts. As the women said about South Sudan, we can generalize to say of our world, moving backwards on many fronts. And then allowing what we see and feel there to allow us and move us, to motivate us, to improve it, as those women wanted to prove themselves, to make it more what God wants it to be. And it can be done. It can be done. We had our board meetings up in North Manchester these last couple of days. That's why I'm in your neighborhood. We had our board meetings there, and board member David Rogers is a member of the North Manchester Church of the Brethren there. He was telling me last night, I hadn't heard this before, telling me about something their youth group had done in their community. I guess the youth had gone to a CCS, the Christian Citizenship Seminar, and I'm betting some kids from here have gone there at some point over the years, where a Church of the Brethren youth, 100 of them, spend a few days in New York City learning about international focus and then go to Washington, D.C. to learn about domestic focus of some particular issue. Something that's troubling in our world. They're focusing on that. And one of the years, it must have been child welfare, the well-being of children in our world and in our nation. That can be depressing. As any of you know, if you read the whatever, or if you go out to see your own community or out beyond, in the world, 168 million child workers. That's just one of the challenges facing children. But in a world today even, 168 million child workers who are out of school, who are out of the opportunities of childhood, they're having to work for their family's income. And in our own country, 1 out of 5 children living in poverty. There's something wrong with that picture. So there's lots to be depressed about. Well, the North Manchester youth heard all this, took it to heart, were deeply troubled themselves, and then came home determined to do something to improve this. They did some research. They found out early childhood education is one of the most important things for getting children off to a good start. I saw something like that on a bumper of somebody's car out here this morning. Read to your child. You know what it says if it's your car. Anyway, early childhood education being a very important part of any child's long-term well-being. And so they did some research what it would take, what was going on in their community already. There was one daycare center with had room for 40 children. It was understaffed and under-equipped, the one little center they had in North Manchester. So they did some research on what it would take to build a new center in their town. $2.5 million. So they went to a big funder in Indiana. If I knew the name, I'd say it. You might know who it was. I can't remember. They went to a big funder. Somebody's got money for stuff like this. But you've got to raise a bunch of the money yourself to as a down payment. And then they'll come in with their bigger grant. Well, the guy, when David was telling me, the guy who they went to meet with said, you know, it's a youth group. I figure they're all fired up for this after that big event out in the East. But they'll come back home. They'll maybe raise $500. They raised $1 million. They went house to house, business to business. They got trained. Jim Chinworth is a youth pastor up there. Maybe you know Jim. He used to be the chaplain at Manchester College. University now, excuse me. Anyway, Jim went with them, got them trained. He would accompany them, but the kids did the sales job. They raised $1 million. Now it's in place, 104 kid capacity. State of the art, and it's the one child care center in Wabash County, I guess that's their county up there, that it has state-sanctioned approval, state license or whatever you call it. So that's what these kids did. They weren't daunted by the challenge. They weren't depressed by the deep level of lament they may have had for the way things were. They chose to act on what they had felt. And they got the Citizen of the Year Award from the local Chamber of Commerce, their youth group at the Manchester Church of the Brethren. Morning to morning, a new day for the kids in that town. So our mourning doesn't need to be debilitating. It can be liberating. It can spur us to action over the things that we care deeply about for God's people and God's earth. And it not only does this sometimes provide tangible improvements, as in a daycare center in North Manchester, as did Jeremiah's purchase, showed a tangible investment in a place that we'll be back to someday, it can inspire those around them to think, yes, there is a future here, in spite of the many troubles that we face. I mentioned earlier our visit to Sequoia and Yosemite in early September. These are indeed some of our most impressive and majestic natural wonders in the United States, and really in the world, we might say. But as I saw the destruction of the forests from the drought and the bark beetles and invasive species and all that stuff, and as we couldn't see the massive stone monoliths in Yosemite because of the forest fires raging through California, because of drought, invasive species, and mismanagement of the forest over decades by people, I find myself slipping into depression, actually. And you know, you don't go to the national parks to be depressed. Finally, on our fifth day, we made our visit down into Yosemite Valley, where you're closer to the big masses. And fortunately, the smoke had cleared a little bit that day, so I got a couple decent pictures. Check out my Facebook page and the album's there. I got a few decent pictures. But we also saw the visitor center there and went in to see what was there. And, of course, every visitor center's got a movie. So we went in to watch the movie on Yosemite and its founding and its current situation, etc. Well, we heard the story of John Muir. Some of you know him, the great naturalist. Actually born in Scotland, immigrated to the United States in the mid-1800s, started out in Detroit, thought better of that, headed out west, ended up in Sequoia, Yosemite, that region, and fell in love with the place. And he was a Christian man. He saw it as a deeply spiritual place that could connect us to God in a way that few other natural things have the ability to, just because of the grandeur of these things. He also saw that this place was under threat at that point in our history. Farmers, ranchers, loggers, miners, they're all moving into these areas. And he thought, if we don't save this now, it's going to be out of our hands. There won't be this left for the future to enjoy and be inspired by. He thought, what can I do? He invited President Teddy Roosevelt out for a 3-day camping trip. Roosevelt took him up on it. And they say that's when Roosevelt turned the corner and became a conservation president. And we think of him as maybe our greatest conservation president. But that camping trip where snow fell outside his tent one night, he wrote in his journal, where he saw these awe-inspiring wonders, brought a change deep within him, and not only went on to protect Yosemite, but many other natural areas in the West. I found my spirits lifted. When I realized what a person of passion and purpose and creativity could do to make something good out of something that is a looming disaster, I began thinking, you know, maybe all is not lost. Let it be the same for us. courageously, compassionately seeing our world for what it is, finding there things that deeply anger or trouble or dismay us, and then letting God use these feelings and this compassion to motivate us, to move us into action for the betterment of all, and our own deep satisfaction at having been part of something that God is doing to make this place a better place. I guess that makes sense of the Beatitude. Blessed are those who mourn. Who would have thought? For they shall be comforted. Amen.